We're back with more of Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North. Many people come to Milwaukee's Irish Fest for the music, and there's certainly a lot of it. But music isn't Ireland's only rich heritage. Ireland has a long and complex history with food. If you've been to the country recently, you know there's a lot more on offer than the stereotypical potatoes and soda bread. But the history of famine and enforced shortages mixed with a deep appreciation of the land, the waters, and their bounty makes the history of food in Ireland a compelling one. It's a history that author Margaret Hickey celebrates in her newest book, Ireland's Green Larder. She's in town to talk about it at Irish Fest this weekend, and she joins Audrey Nowakowski in the studio to explain the title.
Larder is kind of an old-fashioned word now, and it was a place where you kept things cold. And it's not anything to do with the United States, because I went into a shop in Galway asking the lad behind the counter, you know, do you have a copy of my book, Ireland's Green Larder? So he said, Ireland's Green Ladder. So I said, no, not ladder, larder. What's that? So, you know, I know that in a way it's not a word that's in common currency anymore, but it was for most of the period when I was writing, you know, about.
Right. And in that period, you know, your first book, Irish Days, is a collection of oral history, but food in itself can serve as a history in a way, can it not?
Oh, absolutely. That was my whole impetus for writing this, was that most history books are about battles and laws and politics. And that doesn't affect the daily lives of people as much as what is really, really intimate to their lives, and that is food and drink. You know, you can get by if the politics change, but if you have no food, you can't get by. So I thought that a social history and a history of Ireland through food and drink was telling the story in a new way.
Well, Ireland has such a rich history. But especially, I feel, over here in America, people only associate Irish history with famine,
yeah,
with food shortage. So how did you want to tell the history of Ireland through a food lens that wasn't tragic, for a better word to say?
Well, to be absolutely honest, it pretty well was tragic from the beginning. You know, over the centuries, people got by. Sometimes things were better than other times. But I was concentrating on the food of the poor people, for the most part. I do talk about some of the big houses where there were 32 courses for a banquet. But generally speaking, I wanted to go back as far as I possibly could. And I went back to 1,000 years before the pyramids in Egypt, a place called the Kaja Fields. And the Kaja Fields are situated in North County Mayo, so that's on the west coast on the Atlantic. It's a cold, windy, salty kind of spot. But there is the oldest field system that we know about in the world. And so they were growing crops. They were growing early kind of wheat and barley and so on. So from there, right up to the present day, where the food scene is marvelous today, really, really wonderful. There's a renaissance of cheese making, and people are really interested in foraging, and the seafood is magnificent on the west coast. You know, so it's a story of the ups and downs, but for quite a long time, people were short of food.
When it comes to food, obviously, when we think of Ireland, we see green rolling hills, perhaps a lot of coastal rocky shores. So you obviously have the ocean as a source for food. But with Ireland, what I found interesting is that you have the four basic animals, which is very true because, you know, perhaps you just needed those four. So we have the cow, sheep, pig, and horse.
Yes.
You have a quote in your book that says, well, you know what they say, fish is fish and pork is pig, but only beef is meat. So I want to touch upon the importance of Irish cattle.
Oh, you could not have chosen a better one, really, because I'll tell you what it is. On the east coast and down in the southeast, the land is pretty good and you're able to grow crops. And it was always a wealthier coast anyway because it was getting commerce to and from the UK and England. But when you get to the west of the Shannon, that is what they call disadvantaged land. So it's rocky, it's stony, Very difficult to grow crops, even though I've just said the Cager fields were on the West Coast, but just the same. So cattle rearing was what the Irish did for centuries and centuries. And it's a marvelous place to rear cattle because for most of the year, you don't even need to keep the cattle indoors. They can graze outdoors for a very, very long time. And on the cover of my book, I've actually got a picture of a cow called the little hardy Kerry cow, little black cow that you could leave outdoors all winter long. Now, I know that here in Milwaukee, that's probably, you know, impossible to imagine. But in Ireland, where we don't get snow very much, sometimes, but not often. And you counted your wealth in terms of the head of cattle you had. And in Irish mythology, the great cattle raid of Cooley is one of the, you know, the big sagas, like the Atlantic sagas. And you had to have cattle to have prestige. It was cattle rather than money in the bank that made you wealthy.
Now we are, of course, in Wisconsin, which has its own dairy history and heritage. So I'm curious to compare it to the Irish dairy farming. You're famous for the butter, you know, and creeps. So I'm curious if what makes it so special?
Okay. Well, the little Kerry cow is kind of lost in history now. You don't see her anymore. Where I live is quite rural, and all my neighbors are dairy farmers, and they all have Friesians that, for the most part, they're, you know, big black and white cows with very, very heavy milk yield. And so the milk truck, the milk lorry, the chilled milk tanker comes round every day, twice in summer sometimes, and collects the milk, and then it's all taken. So that's for the big creameries. There is a renaissance, as you mentioned, of individual cheese making. And again, within walking distance of me, I've got, well, that's an exaggeration, not really.
Technically.
If you were a good walker. But within a short distance of me, I've got two women who are making gold medal winning cheeses. One woman makes goat's milk cheese, and it's fabulous. And the other one makes a Swiss style of cheese from cow's milk. So, yeah, there's a real love of cheese and butter. I say in the book that butter is the golden thread that runs through the tapestry of Irish food history, because it really was so hugely important over the centuries. And, you know, to mention the famine, and I'm sorry to do it, but you can't,
of course,
avoid
yeah.
it. At the time when people were literally starving, they were producing butter, packing it into wooden firkins and exporting it. And they were doing that because the money that they got for the butter paid the rent. And if they didn't pay the rent, they were evicted. And the houses that they were living in were destroyed, so they couldn't creep back into them. So butter, a golden butter, I mean, Irish butter is so delicious. It really, really is. And there's all kinds of people making farmhouse butter now.
And do you think that Ireland's food, cultural, agricultural history is holding on much stronger compared to other countries where, you know, big agriculture is the norm?
Yes. Yes, that's a really good question, because the small farmer still exists in Ireland. It's beginning to change because it's a hard life. You know, if you're a farmer or a farmer's wife, and farmer's wife isn't sitting in the kitchen, she's also getting her hands dirty and her wellies on. She and he will be devoted to that farm, particularly dairy farming. They have to get a relief milker if they want to go on holiday. They have to make arrangements if they want to go to a wedding for the day. You know, normally you are tied to your farm. Your children maybe don't want to follow in your footsteps, you know. So it could be changing. But at the moment, if you fly into Ireland, I fly into Shannon because that's my nearest airport, you just see a multiplicity of small fields with hedgerows around them. And it's a dream. And I really hope that we don't go the way of massive agriculture. I think it's healthier for the planet to have small farms, well-maintained, you know, it's lovely.
Well, and you say in your book, at the root of Irish food and cooking is great, honest ingredients and respect for the land.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. I mean, when I first moved, because I didn't always live where I live now, I lived in London a very, very, very long time. And I made a decision around about 1999 to see the Millennium Inn in Ireland. So I moved over and I became aware of how observant local people were. They would see things and mention them, and I'd be catching up with them because they'd, you know, they've got a very sharp eye, and they would be talking about, well, you go over that little bridge. I was expecting to see something like the Golden Gate Bridge, you know, but in fact, a little bridge is a tiny little hump in the road that you wouldn't even know was a bridge unless you were local. But yeah, simple ingredients was simply because there was no access to anything except what you produced yourself, except down the line, tobacco was imported, sugar was imported. But otherwise, you try to be pretty self-sufficient, you know.
Which I think leads to the misconception that perhaps Irish food is boring for people who haven't been there. You know, they think potatoes, fish, salmon, perhaps, and not much else. But yeah, what kind of misconceptions did you want to address in diving into the food history here?
Yeah, well, I'll tell you really how I came even to write the book. And that was that I bought a cottage. Nobody else would have bought it because I was, you know, it was a kind of honeymoon period in my life when I just was in love with Ireland. And I bought this place. It had no electricity. It had no running water. It hadn't been lived in for about 15 years. The windows were rotten and broken. And, you know, everything was wrong with it, except that I could see, you know, how nice it could be. And the thing that really sold me was the massive fireplace. And there was a thing called a crane. And the crane is a metal bar that's set into the side of the fireplace. And an arm swings out. It's like a hinge that swings out. And from that arm, you can suspend pots on chains and hooks and so on. And so the method of cooking was on the flat of the hearth. Turf peat, which is dug up from the bog nearby, turf is burned, and then you can have a multiplicity of pans going. You can have a pan at the back there, and it's a little bit cooler. You can have a great big pot of potatoes boiling over the thing, because there were very big families. You know, for a long, long time, there were a family of 15 wouldn't be exceptional, you know. Well, no, it would be exceptional, but it wouldn't be unheard of. So they were using the crane to cook things. They were also using the ashes of the turf to cook. And I bought a salmon and wrapped it in leaves and buried it in the ashes of the turf. And when the leaves of the cabbage were all charred and blackened, I pulled it out, opened up the parcel. And the salmon inside was perfectly cooked, you know, pink and juicy and delicious. So they were ingenious in using very simple ingredients and cooking in a very simple way. Frying, boiling, not a great deal of baking other than bread. Most things were fried or boiled. But
well, and even the bread didn't have to be risen, you know.
No, exactly, on yeast. Exactly. Yeah, I mean, although for a long, long time, I mean, soda bread now is, you know, a delicious bread, but it's a fairly much a Johnny come lately. It's only in the 18th century that bicarbonate soda came along. Before that, they discovered a kind of sourdough method. And so if you go back in the history of bread making in Ireland, they were making a kind of sourdough bread long before it became fashionable, you know. So, yes, simple ingredients, but always with a little twist. And, of course, lashings of butter in good times when you could afford the butter. And that really transforms anything that you eat, I think.
Obviously, this can be traced to other countries, but I feel like Ireland's relationship with food is so reliant on what is, as you mentioned, what's happening to the people, you know, the food scarcity, the political happenings at the time. even the presence of the monasteries to start. You know, that's such a big component of not just Irish history, but the food history. So what kind of things were you discovering that you found particularly surprising or interesting? Or did you find throughout time that there's just this big balancing act depending on what's happening up here and trickling down to the people trying to sustain their life?
Yeah, well, I mean, looked at from the point of view of the small tenant farmer or laborer, times were good or bad depending on the political situation of the time. But there was a period in the 17th and 18th centuries, particularly the 18th century, when Ireland was the second city of the British Empire. They had its own parliament, magnificent buildings. If you go to Dublin, you'll see the Customs House, you'll see the Bank of Ireland, all these glorious buildings, very, very grand period of Georgian architecture. That was a period of prosperity. And in the big houses, you would have the most elaborate and lavish meals. And so there was a bit of trickle down so that people, even in the worst of rural poverty, there would be a little loosening of the shackles, if you like, and they, you know, they'd have a pig and they'd maybe slaughter the pig and everybody would share some of the meat. And the monasteries, going back earlier, the monasteries were always there partly as hospitals. They would mind the sick, but they felt it a duty, a Christian duty, to feed the hungry. And so every monastery, and it was a monastery, was often a very big settlement with its own cattle and its own bakery and so on. People could come and be fed. And the monks, being a little more educated, were the ones who knew how to make cheese. And at a period when the Christian monks were going abroad, they were taking their cheese-making skills with them and going into France and into Switzerland and teaching people how to make cheese. You know, they were great travelers, those early Christian monks.
In your book, it said, what is put on a plate reveals much about a nation. And you span through so much history, so many dishes, so many categories of dishes, but I suppose it changes every day, but right now, what's your ideal plate to showcase Ireland?
Oh, right. Well, for me personally, I absolutely love an oyster. And there's a little place in Galway, it's called Moran's of the Weir. And it was actually the house that belonged to a family called Moran. It was a thatched cottage overlooking a weir. There's a swan. I don't know whether they pay the swan to swim up and down, but there nearly always seems to be a swan on the water. And of course, now it's extended because it became very, very popular as a place to go and get seafood. I mean, you can get crab claws, you can get mussels, you can get oysters is my favorite. And of course, what goes with oysters particularly well is a pint of Guinness. And there's a couple of rooms at the front of Moran's where you can go in, sit down with your friends, shut the door, and just have a little private room to yourselves. And it's a dream, really. And of course, now there are several Michelin star restaurants in Ireland as well, because there's a drive for honoring the ingredients of your locality. So there's a chef who's here in Milwaukee at the moment now, Martin. He's from 12 Pins, which is part of Galway's wonderful culinary scene at the moment. He's big into foraging. That seems to be the watchword at the moment. There's another chef in Galway who is trying to serve only local ingredients. He said to me it took a long time to wean himself off black pepper because he couldn't allow it because it wasn't local, you know. So, you really are now coming into Ireland at a time of probably the best food it's ever had.
Well, Margaret, I want to thank you for offering us not just the perspective of today's Ireland with food, but throughout history with your book. And thank you for coming in today.
It was a pleasure. Thanks very much for having me.
Margaret Hickey lives and writes in Ireland. Her newest book is called Ireland's Green Larder. She'll be at the literary tent at Irish Fest this weekend. There's a link to her schedule and more information about the book at wuwm.com. She spoke with Audrey Nowakowski.